dear listener, and welcome to another episode of 10 Laws with East Forest Podcast. This is a podcast that explores through conversation with people issues like consciousness, spirituality, nature, ecology, technology, music, pretty much whatever I'm interested in or whatever that person's into, we'll drop into it. And sometimes, too, there'll be some music, some live cuts, some meditations, figuring this out as we go along. So thanks for joining us. If you do enjoy this podcast, please share it. Share it on social media. Share it with your friends. Give us a nice review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. And you can always reach out at eastforest.org. And if you want to say hi or ask any questions, info@eastforest.org. That's also the same place you can send us moolah with PayPal. So today my guest is Matt Cochran, and he's someone I know from town, and he's someone who has a really interesting and unique approach to dreams and to dreaming and how to work with your dreams, something he calls dream tracking. And it was a different experience for me than your typical, pretty much it's quite unique. It's more metaphorical and myth-based than anything I've really experienced before. But I do want to say that you're going to hear probably in the background some rattling around, and the whole trailer here was shaken because there was some super intense wind going on. But we muscled through, so you're going to hear some environmental field sounds in the mix there. But yeah, we are here in southern Utah where this one was recorded. I was just outside before dropping in to record this intro, chopping some wood for the sauna, which is a wonderful experience, a new thing that I've just completing building out here. And I was sitting there chopping the wood thinking, like, this is, you know, here I just need to carry some water and I've completed my tasks for the day, right? But there is something very satisfying about chopping wood for heat. And it's a connection to nature. I was like standing out there, and just as I was doing that, there were like these beautiful geese, you know, making these sounds ricocheting off the slick rock. The sun's going down, and I'm just feeling a lot of gratitude for being out here and being able to be so seeped in nature just day to day, even if it is super windy sometimes. So yeah, let's get into it. This is Matt Cochran, a wonderful man, sweetheart, wise soul. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Scott showed me your dream book.
Oh, these?
Yeah.
You don't have one? Yeah, you want.
Sweet.
You gotta have a dream.
No, I'll use it if you give it to me for
all
sure.
Right. Matt, thank you so much for coming. And I will give you a dream journal, I promise.
Thanks, Trevor. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here. I wanted to talk to you because you're someone I know in town, but we've been getting into some dream work together. And I found that you kind of had a unique approach to, I don't know, just your outlook on what dreams are, how you work with them. And since we've been doing the dream circle, the dream group, it's just been making me think a lot differently about it. And I mean, look, you know, dreams are something that I think we've all kind of, some people process their dreams in different ways, but I had never kind of approached it quite in the sort of mythical way, maybe mm-hmm. that you were doing it. So, I just want to start by just starting off from a very broad space of, like, you know, what do you consider, how do you define working with dreams? What does that mean for you? You know, what are some of those pitfalls that come up for you? Maybe just for yourself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, dreams are interesting because there's a lot of people out there that have formal training and like psychotherapy and Jungian. And
but don't you have some
Freud.
Kind of formal training?
I do, yeah. but I also realize that's, you know, one lens of a multifaceted way of being with dreams. And when you look in beyond the formal training, what I started doing was studying how a lot of indigenous cultures, historic cultures, we're talking like, you know, from the Greeks to the Australian Aborigines to the Iroquois, how mm-hmm. everyone in the past has, you know, honored and used dreams in such a way. And when you start to see that there's not one culture that hasn't been involved with dreams, then you realize that psychotherapy is just one way of looking at things in a dreaming fashion. And so I guess, you know, to answer your question, the basic premise that I've come to with dreams and my own experience and having worked with, you know, hundreds of people in dreams and dream circles is that dreams themselves are a presence. They're something that's very alive and animated. And mainly what I, you know, if it's been a good day talking to someone about dreams, they have a closer relationship to their own dreams. And so I talk a lot about how do you engender this relationship. I guess maybe I'll start with that.
What do you, when you say work with your dreams, how do you work with your dreams? What does that mean to you?
Well, it means, you know, I call what I do dream tracking, and it can, because I feel like, you know, we dream every night, and...
Do we?
We do. We might not remember them.
I guess we do. Like, if we're in REM sleep, are we always dreaming?
We're always dreaming, yeah. Rapid eye movement, that's so they say, and we go through 5 to 7 sleep cycles a night. So potentially we're dreaming 5 or 7 different dreams in a night.
Are you always also sexually erect when you're dreaming? Women
typically are, yes.
Is that like always?
I don't know about always. I haven't looked at the research
there. There's some weird things that happen when you fall asleep. I mean, your body paralyzes yourself and like your blood goes in all these weird places.
Right.
And
what's the allure of dreams, right? What is this presence?
I don't know. Maybe it's a sexual act with the mystery or something.
It could very well be.
So you were talking about, sorry, I got into some toilet talk there, about working with your dreams and the ways that you do it. Like, what is the work? You know, what are some techniques? What's that process?
Well, the first thing is you need to remember your dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people start off with saying, I don't remember my dreams. And so, you know, you put a journal by your bed at night. You start sort of putting yourself with the intention of, I'm going to remember my dreams, or I want to get closer to my dreams. And so once you start remembering your dreams, you start tracking them. You start writing them down, giving them a title. What is this drama that's going on every night? What is this strange, sometimes horrific, sometimes utterly ridiculous story that sometimes even has mythic dimensions to it? It feels bigger than me. And then from there, you know, you start, or what I teach and what you start to learn is that dreams have this old or archaic, mythic, poetic language. And it takes some learning to understand how they might be speaking to us.
So then you're not looking at it so literally. It's not like one of those dream books that it's like you see a cat, that means this. You're in the ocean, it means that. It's much more poetry, myth, metaphor.
Correct.
Or even cross time in a way. You know, one dream to another dream to someone else's dream.
Right.
That was another level you brought to this that was new for me.
Well, and inherently, like you were just saying in a different context, it's a mystery. And it's in some ways fathomless when you start getting into dreams, that your world keeps getting bigger because you're entering this other world. You just said something about, so pop psychology will say, I dreamed of a snake. That means kundalini energy. That means this or that, you know, and it gives a sort of a generalized snapshot of a snake. But but everyone at some point probably dreams of a snake. And everyone's interpretation or idea or life experience with a snake is different. So what happens is when you start getting into it, you realize that dreams are almost crafted for each of us. And there's sort of a personal uniqueness. And it's as if what I've seen over the years, it's as if dreams are this place that helps us navigate and nudges us in directions of perhaps, for lack of a better word, soul or spirit, this deeper, under the surface way of living, towards mysterious longing, if that makes any sense.
Sort of.
Yeah.
So, like, who's nudging who? You know, like, we know we have an unconscious, right?
Right.
And we know there's a lot going on in our brains when we're dreaming. And I think a lot of us have anxiety dreams, as it's called, or we would just define it as that, where, like, there's a lot of gobbledygook. And sometimes, like, this happens often a lot, sort of. You're doing something, maybe a lot that day, and you end up, you're kind of stuck in that dream. Sort of the architecture of your dream is like, let's say you're gardening all day, or I'm working on a song all day. Sometimes right. I'm in the studio in my dream. And it's sort of like, I try not to get too caught up in the details in a way. Sort of the meaning of maybe what's happening during that dream is more important perhaps than the fact that I was in a studio, because like that's almost like, my brain, it's sort of obvious. It's like, well, of course you were. That's, you know, you went to sleep with these images like so fresh and moving around. So where do you find that line between, how do I put it? Truth and sort of don't take it too seriously.
Okay. Well, a couple things. Typically, if you think a dream is mundane and it's, and you just said, well, because I did this, I dreamed that way.
Yeah.
Other people will say, the dream picked up what I was doing and made some sort of story from it.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of times people say, if you have a mundane dream and you think you know what's going on, you've probably missed it. So in my experience, it's very rare that there's a mundane dream. The way you recognize the truth of a dream that I've seen over and over is I don't interpret other people's dreams. I can't tell you what's happening in your dream. I can ask questions, steer, suggest things, relate it to mythic plots and old sort of metaphors and analogies. But it's the dreamer, him or herself, that has, there's this moment of inner recognition when something comes true in a dream. So only you can really understand when a dream is true for you. And I think from your own experience already, you know when that's happened.
You mean like the dreams that stick out in a sense? Like there's a certain potency to them?
Yes.
All right. Well, one side note, you're talking about writing down your dreams. And I've known in the past that when you start that practice, it strengthens the muscle of retention and recall, and you start to remember more and more over the nights. But what I've been doing lately is the voice recordings, which has been working better for me because there's a resistance in when I wake up to turning on a light because it really wakes you up.
Right.
You know? And I can really just grab the phone in the dark and start mumbling for a while.
Yeah.
Sort of in the dream almost, right?
Yeah.
And then just check that out later. And there are times where I don't even remember doing that so much. And then I go back to listen to the voice memos. And these are just particularly potent dreams.
Yeah.
And then I had completely forgotten that dream, that moment. And then I start seeing the connections between dreams. I never would have remembered. They would have just been gone
with that. That's great. Wind. Yeah.
And so, you know, we have little bits of technology like that, that if that resonates with someone, you know, I think that's a cool way.
I think it's really important. I mean, some people, you know, it depends on who it is. Some people do better writing. Some people do better recording.
Yeah.
Some people just have a playback memory when they wake up and they just run it through their head.
Yeah.
One thing I do want to, it's not really correct you on, but you said, well, you know, when you start writing down or recording your dreams, you're exercising this muscle,
mm-hmm.
You know, so you remember better. I say it differently. I say in some ways, because of your intention, you've started a relationship with dreams and they are responding now that you are giving it attention.
That's interesting. So that definition sort of implies that the dream is an other.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's other working through it.
Right.
Or it's a canvas that is being worked with by the mystery or spirit, soul, all in one, that which is beyond maybe our dualistic mind.
Well, think about it too. It's like when you wake up, you say, I had a dream, but that's actually a false statement as far as I know, because when I wake up, I realize that the dream has had me. I've been pulled into a much greater reality. And I don't know how it works.
That's for sure.
Some part of me, but it's not like I created it, right? Some part of me, some part of my spirit, essence, soul actually traveled somewhere. I have no idea where. And it experienced a very real reality in that format and then returned. And when I woke up, I lived that story.
Yes. I mean, everyone would agree that when you're in a dream, you're in that reality, except when you're lucid, which is quite rare. And and you could think about it, like, what's the difference between lucidity in a dream and lucidity in our waking consciousness? If I have the awareness that I'm conscious, isn't that just another form of lucidity, except for the fact that I'm not in some holodeck that I can just, like, I guess I could in my mind, right?
Right.
You could imagine anything you want and sort of transport to any, I could just be in these places, and maybe so that's not that different.
Are you lucid enough now to know that you're dreaming or not?
Well, that's what I was going to get to is like, you know, a lot of people talk about, hey, you're in a dream, you just woke up into another one. And, or this, you know, that's in a lot of ancient wisdoms that this is a dream too, or this is the illusion of reality. And I resonate with that just thinking about it from a psychedelic point of view and my own experiences of non-duality where my brain just went there and I had a felt experience in what I considered to be waking consciousness of, beyond mind. And so it's more of a feeling and knowing. And because of that, it makes you question. But, the longer you're, I don't know, there's a little bit of a cop-out to me when people say, well, this is a dream. Or don't worry, you know, just remember, this is all just, this is some illusion. And a part of me is like, absolutely, I totally get it. I'm with you. And part of me is like, but God damn it, this hurts. You know, like there's suffering here. And like, and this is
within
real.
The dream, you mean?
This is real in a sense of like, I see it and I feel it myself. Yeah. I see it in others. And it's like, I don't want to just throw it away. And I'm just being honest. And I don't know the feelings that come up. But when someone says it's a dream, they're kind of implying that it doesn't matter.
Right.
That's not real.
Right.
You know, and it's like, if you think about it, the thought of like, it's even just on the level of neurons firing in your brain, that's exactly the same realness as it is now when they're firing in my brain.
Yeah. Yep.
So what is it?
You know? And dream is, you know, and a couple of things that from what you're saying, I mean, I agree with you. It's like, I think, the way that the modern world has looked at imagination or dreaming, as some sort of illusionary thing or something that's not quite real, I think is a big, big mistake.
Well, it's probably a Western thing, right?
Right. And it's a fear of the unknown in a way, and the other.
That which isn't controlled.
Yeah. And the unconscious is what we don't know, we don't know. And, you know, it's the greater realm, and we are just a part of that slowly increasing in capacity each time our soul or spirit has a challenge, you might say. But, you know, like you were mentioning, one of the oldest Chinese texts, the Changzu, you know, one of the great famous quotes, I mean, thousands of years old, is, you know, I dreamed I was a butterfly, and when I woke up, I wondered if I'm dreaming that I'm a man, you know, or a butterfly dreaming that I'm a man. And the question has gone back and back and back. And so a question that I hold in my own mind is, okay, dreams actually, you know, everything dreams. We watch our dogs dream when they're sleeping.
Yeah, rats dream.
Right. I mean, I guess we don't really know if trees dream and so on, but, you know, ancient cultures believed everything dreamt. The earth was dreaming.
Yeah, if you look at it from a perspective of octaves of consciousness. Yeah.
And then evolutionarily, though, why is dreaming here, right? It's been with us from the beginning. There must be something incredibly crucial to it. Mm-hmm. One way I try and sometimes describe dreams to other people are like, what is this presence that comes to each of us every night if we, you know, create the ability to remember them and come into relationship with them? What is this presence that brings these stories to us? And, you know, why are they crafted? uniquely for us. It's not like I have to go depend on or pay a guru, to me, there's something inherently I can trust. It's not some marketed thing. It's not a divination deck. It's not that has 52 ways of possibilities, right? With the dreams, infinite information comes through every night, and it's tailored specifically for us. That's my experience. I mean, that blows me away.
Yeah. What is the thing that's working with us? Because
right.
I think that's what freaks people out, is there's so much information. You can have so much go on in one dream.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times you wake up, and without any sort of information on how to work with this, the feeling is just, the fuck was that?
You know, right. Like, right.
I'm sure we all have those dreams. It's just what in the world was that all about? It's just like, I don't know where to start.
Right. And one of the most sort of basic languages of dream is it speaks through emotion. So you wake up and a dream's grabbed you, right? But you're in grief, you're angry, you've been horrified, or you've been in some sort of ecstasy. But dreams want to be remembered, and they sort of imprint us with very strong emotions, things we might not even be able to touch in the day world, because they're so, like, you know, anger, these dreams can be incredibly violent. You'd be arrested if you did anything like that in life. But there's a different, even morality within the dreamscape.
Yeah.
And so
I've had many dreams where I wake up and I'm so glad when I realize that moment it was a dream.
Right.
Like the horror of the reality of, you know, whatever crime I'd committed or whatever I'd done.
Right.
And then you wake up and it's like, oh, thank God. Thank God. Praise Jesus. That's
a dream. Yet at the same time, who's commenting on the dream now? God, it's like sort of your, but it's sort of like your ego or your waking consciousness, a smaller part of yourself. And then, so what I have people do is, here's an example. And maybe not as horrific as the dream you were talking about. A woman I know dreamed that a grizzly bear was chasing her. And she came into a dream group that morning, and she was upset. She was scared, and she was angry because she's like, I can't believe this bear's chasing me. And, you know, it's got to be bad. And
so sort of literal.
And just like sort of a bodily fear. And so I said, well, let's go back into the dream, meaning let's sort of drop your mind back into the dream, and I'll be there too, sort of walking along, describing what you're seeing and so on.
Sort of a meditation.
Yeah, meditation. You can say dreams are doorways back into these places. And so this woman went back into the dream, and, you know, the bear's chasing her. And I said, well, what's going on? She's like, well, actually, it's sort of exciting. And we moved through it, and within the dream, there had been no fear. There had been no anger. This was her day world mind commenting on what was happening in the dream. In the dream, there was this excitement and this different sort of energy. So you see what I'm saying? You have to follow the dream from the dream's perspective. And to objectify a dream or to interpret it from an ego standpoint is missing the point. You see, you're outside the dream here commenting.
So you're kind of talking about working with it, with feeling.
Mm-hmm.
In a way.
Re-entering the dream and watching the dream from the inside.
Yeah, that is a very different approach and something I hadn't tried before. This idea of consciously entering into a dream through recall and meditation, being guided and seeing how it feels, what comes back.
You know, right. And I know from your own experiences, you've picked up valid and probably really helpful nudges and ways to move forward with day world challenges, you know, by doing that.
Yeah. It's not like you're given any clear answers. It's just, it is chasing a feeling in a way, which is sort of what all life is.
Well, I think it increases capacity and gives you options and opens your awareness rather than your sort of typical habitual way of going at things. It constantly, when I say dreams nudge you, they keep us in balance by throwing us off balance.
So how can people do this like on their own? No.
It's difficult to do on your own. The best thing to do though is to start writing them down or voice recording them or something. And then without even interpreting them, if it feels right, sharing them with your partner, with your friends in the morning. One of the things many indigenous tribes did, you know, including the Iroquois, is they thought dreams weren't just personal, that they were actually stories for the community. So when they woke up in the morning, they actually shared dreams among their family, because sometimes one person's dream was for someone else and affected them deeply. So you'll find, and I think you've seen in some of our, in some of the dream groups, you know, even if you don't remember a dream and you come into that dream group, you walk away with three other multifaceted and really interesting stories that may have some sort of an impact on you as you walk away. It's like sharing old stories, but you haven't had to make them up. They've just come to you.
Hmm. Let me ask you about some like kind of iconoclastic things about dreams.
Sure.
To get your point on this. We've hit a few of them, but like, what do you make of dreams when, you know, people have repetitive dreams?
Okay. Well, I mean, this is...
What do you make of your teeth falling out now?
Yeah, that's one of the top 10, right? But first, on repetitive dreams, typically repetitive dreams are even more important, because it's like, and I'm going to bring nightmares in on this too.
Oh, yeah.
The scariest dreams we have, and a lot of times nightmares are repetitive dreams, right? Think of childhood. Almost all, many of us in our childhood have had repetitive and scary mm-hmm. dreams. And typically, those are really important dreams, because there's something in there trying to get our attention. And I can give you an example in a minute. I'll give it to you now. A person I know once dreamt for months on end that, and then this is a typical dream, that he was being chased by someone or something or things, shadowy, it was dark. And, you know, that feeling that you're trying to run away, but your legs slow down. Spaghetti noodle sort of.
Yeah.
And always he got very fearful in the dream, terror stricken, panicked, and sort of, you know, in that thing, you sort of wake yourself up. Right. And you wake up, you're like, oh, thank God I'm out of that dream. Mm-hmm. Right. And so he kept having this, and he showed up at, and finally sort of shared this at a dream group once. And, you know, one thing, so I asked, well, what do you think they want? And he said, oh, I don't know. You know, I said, well, you know, maybe if you get a chance and you can get through your panic and terror, you might ask them, if you dream this again, what is it they want? And so,
you know, that's sort of a form of lucidity, though, isn't it, for him to even remember that?
It is, but you'd be surprised that it can, you know, how that lucidity works. I can't define for you, but sometimes, you know, it's like setting an intention, mm-hmm. trying to get some information, mm-hmm. becoming lucid, right? And with a repetitive dream. So he, you know, weeks went by, and then one day he showed up at the dream group, and he had this sort of smirk on his face. You know, this is sort of his style of being amused and like, oh, something happened, you know? And so I said, well, what happened? He said, well, I was able to turn in the dream, you know, finally, and just said, what do you want? You know, ask him what they want. And these things that were chasing him said, you know, we're actually your friends and we've been trying to catch up with you, but you've been moving so fast, we haven't been able to catch up with you. And so he was one of those guys that just like he had a fuse lit under him, you know, he was go, 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 go. And so the dream was, you know, saying basically, maybe you should slow down. And this thing that seems to be chasing you is actually your ally and not something to fear. And it's just asking you to slow down so we can catch up. And, you know, I don't know if that makes some sense, but it's interesting when you face what terrifies you.
Yeah, that interpretation or that story, whatever you want to call it, has a fairly clear meaning. And if you're not looking at it like, you know, the typical, you know, something in a dream represents this, then that's more of like a message.
Right.
And these people who say they're his friends, you know, message from whom? A message from his soul guides, from his unconscious, all of the above.
Right.
I mean, is it fair to say sometimes you're sort of receiving messages, tips in a way?
I would say so. And for that dream, that was the real start of his dream tracking, right? Is then a whole theme of dreams. Because once you get through the, once you attend a repetitive dream, it stops repeating and you get a whole new orchestration of dreams coming in. And so a whole new pathway to follow.
What do you make of in dreams when you see dead people? Well, or you're in the dream, you feel like you're communicating with that person. Sometimes it's straight
someone
up.
You know who's dead.
Yeah, sometimes it's straight up, you're having a conversation. Yeah. Sometimes it's you can just sense that's what's going on.
Right.
And that's very, for a lot of people, that's very positive and healing.
Yeah.
And profound. Do you take credence to the thought that this is a way for things of other dimensional realities to cross into our own lives?
All of the above. But usually what I say when people dream of someone that's died in their life and that person's visiting in a dream, I say it's a gift.
Yeah. And I think they feel like
yeah. And so, you know, what you do with that and what the message is and or the communication might be is always going to change and be different according to the person who's dreamt it, that, and their life and so on, the circumstances. But if, you know, someone you know who's died comes to you, it's a gift, you know,
that's
so just a simple way to hold it, I think. So,
yeah.
And I think many of us have had those visitations for sure.
What do you make of premonitions? When you dream something that you feel like is clearly in the dream, it's in the future. You feel the person feels that it's a sort of message to them or others.
There are many, you know, there are so many different types of dreams, and dreams certainly are prophetic. Everyone has a different style of dreaming. So there are some people that dream more prophetically. I knew a man who dreamed of earthquakes worldwide. Couldn't say where, but a few days before they happened, then it came out in the news, he'd known that an earthquake was going to happen.
Only in his dreams?
In his dreams. There's no, we never came up with an answer for why that's happening.
Yeah.
But, you know, and so dreams can be really important that way. Like, we've been talking about, well, dreams are metaphorical and they're myth-like and they're telling stories that aren't so literal, but sometimes dreams can be completely literal. Someone dreams their partner's driving over the mountain the next morning at mile marker 57. They hit a snowbank. When you wake up, you want to say, you want to do your literal test, check, say, okay, was that is that something that I should attend to?
Right.
If so, hey, you know, honey, before you drive over the mountain, be really careful at marker 57 or don't go over today. I have, you know, so that can also save lives. I have another friend who, I don't know if I told you this story, but hiking in the Tetons once, older brother, the relationships were the girlfriend's younger brother and the boyfriend. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The boyfriend, dreamed the night before that, the girlfriend's brother stepped off a rock and fell. And he was so terrified of the dream, he didn't say a thing to anybody, but he shadowed that kid all day long in the hike. And at this one point, as the kid was crossing a rock, he started to fall, and Keith grabbed him by the coat, and he still broke his foot, but he saved him from about a 50-foot fall. And he didn't want to talk about that dream because it upset him so bad that he actually, even though it saved the kid's life, that the premonition just scared the crap out of him. So
it's a lot of responsibility too.
Exactly. So
to acknowledge, in a sense,
right,
the power of what's coming through. You know, you want to pay attention.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, what is this information that comes through dreams? Déjà vu, French for already seen. Okay.
Is that what it means?
Yeah.
Already seen.
Right.
Uh huh.
So we've all had that feeling, mm-hmm, right? Most people think they come from some previous dream that you may have forgotten. That sort of all of a sudden, that visceral body sense that, oh, I've been here before.
It'd be interesting to hear like a neuroscientist approach to the evolutionary purpose of dreaming.
Yeah, and even to track the neural pathways when you're dreaming, what's happening up there? You know,
but doesn't your brain light up sort of like it does on a psychedelic? Like different parts of your brain are connecting and lighting up.
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but I imagine that's the case. But there's also something more going on than neural pathways in the science, right?
Sure. I was just curious. Yeah. Like, I really don't know what the purpose that, you know, the physical, what the theories are and the physical purpose of dreaming.
Right.
There must be theories. And I'm sure no one really knows. But we know that if you don't sleep and don't dream, eventually you go crazy and die. Like,
right. Sleep deprivation isn't necessarily lack of sleep. It's the lack of dreaming. It's the lack
the REM
of...
is what's so important.
Right.
Yeah. Right. To restful sleep and some kind of just overall, like, to be alive, you have to do that.
Right.
And the more well you do it, usually the more health you have.
Right.
There's more and more and more research, you know, about sleep and the importance of it.
And vitality. And sleep's become a funny thing in the modern world. With all our lights and electricity running around us and screens and so on, it's affected our brainwaves. And there used to be a romance with sleep, you know, even in the 1800s. And they used to say there was a first sleep and a second sleep during the night. And you woke up in the middle of the night and you were in this. You talked about waking up and not wanting to turn on lights.
Yeah.
Back when there was no electricity, you woke up in the middle of the night and you had these several hours of being sort of in this half awake thing. And a lot of, indigenous cultures and historic cultures would talk to each other, tell stories then, or do something in the dark, you know, and then go back for their second sleep and dream again. You know, it's just so different than it was. Like, people loved, they sort of courted sleep.
Yeah.
It was this way different thing than saying, shit, I need to get 6 hours tonight before I got to get up and go to work tomorrow. Right.
We've heard about people who smoke pot who don't dream much. And then it's something about the melatonin. And then when they stop smoking, heavy pot smokers report that they just dream like crazy.
Really? That's interesting. You think it's,
it has something to do with when you smoke, it uses up melatonin, something like that.
Yeah.
And I've heard some smokers will, like, take sublingual melatonin as a way to help them dream and stuff. Mm. But, I mean, they're obviously dreaming. So it has something to do with memory.
Well, you wonder if, you know, if they're sort of in a state of dreaming when they're high anyway, so they don't need, the brain doesn't need to, right? To some
extent.
That
actually could be too. It's the brain's just like, I'm good. It's like, we can just chill.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess, which route do you want to take?
I don't know. My sister says she doesn't dream, but she doesn't smoke pot.
Right.
But I would presume she's just not remembering them. I don't know. It's very strange.
Mm-hmm.
You live a fairly untraditional life. Yeah, in the American sense. I mean, you've been living out here in Southern Utah for 10 years?
Yeah.
About that? And you live fairly off-grid-ish, I mean, more or less, for all intents and purpose. And recently, you've sort of completed your own house, but before that, you're living in a yurt, right, to sleep?
A wall tent, yeah.
A wall tent.
Yeah.
And you have a little Airstream as a kitchen, but you're outside a lot, and you're very much... you and Constance, your partner, are very much in the rhythms of the land. Like, today it's so windy, and you're well aware of that. Right? Like, that's part of our lives and part of your life. And you've been, you guys grow a lot of your own food, and you do it, right? You're doing that stuff. And I'm curious if you noticed a change, if you can remember back from before that. I'm not really sure where you were before, but... if as you got into these natural rhythms, especially when you're in one place like that, if it deepened your experience with your dreams, deepened the messages and the myth that was coming through.
Well, you know, before, I mean, and before...
Where were you before?
I was in Missoula, Montana for years, and I did live in the town, but I still spent an enormous amount of time outdoors. And I was a mapper and a surveyor back then, so I was outside and, you know, mapping basically wilderness areas and boundary work and stuff. But I did have the traditional, you got to get up and go to work, and there were the stoplights, and there was the alarm, and there were the roommates, and there was, you know, the that whole sense of things, of life. I call it a stuttered life, because you're always stopping and starting.
So what's the life part that you're interrupting? The moments of not doing?
That's a good question. But what I found then was I dreamed intensely back then as well, as if the dreams were actually disrupting what I was doing in a way. It's a longer story, but they nudged me out of that place.
Mm.
I would say since I've been here dreams have become less of a cerebral exercise than an embodied living. Uh-huh. And there's some days, and I'll speak to this in a sec, there's some days where my waking life seems very dreamlike. Like that bridge has been crossed. And so how I walk through life, I'm sensing, living, witnessing bigger stories in my day world. Does that make sense?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds beautiful.
And so, and you know,
caught
and
in the small shit too. It's more of a,
well, yeah, you can never escape the,
but you know what I mean? There's always that overarching awareness. Maybe that's what something about when you're more ensconced in nature is that it strengthens that connection to the larger, to your sense of self that's bigger.
Right, to your mythic sense of self, your spirit, your soul, or however
the sphere you might of your look. Living, your awareness maybe can it has a bit larger sphere.
And so one of the things I've noticed over the years, especially since I've been here, and this has been especially the last 4 years, I've been following it really closely, is I personally believe that the language of dreams and the language of nature are almost the same thing.
Say more about that.
The way when I move through a landscape out here and I experience it, and when I move through how it, in some ways, it visually moves around me, how the echoes of small sand ripples, you know, hit like a larger stream bed bottom, the patterns, the poetics of space, and I don't know if I'm describing, it's really hard to put into words.
I think it's beautiful, and I vibe everything you're saying. I mean, a lot of what you're saying is like, if these are natural shapes, sounds, these are the sounds of that which is wild.
Right.
And for many people, when I lived in New York City, there was nothing.
Right.
I mean, every inch has been created.
Yeah.
And when you live in a grid, after a while, maybe your mind starts to think a different way.
Right? Yeah, I totally agree with that.
There's no straight lines here.
Exactly.
And that's sort of a good way. That in itself is a myth about what it means to be alive.
Exactly. And we live in a, out here in southern Utah, we actually live in a labyrinth. A maze, you know, and so the mythic dimensions behind that itself is really fascinating when you think of the Greeks and Theseus and Minotaur, and it's just, you know, every place has its own mythic presence even. And so what I've noticed, and James Hillman, who's an archetypal psychologist and who sort of broke some of the traditional frame and psychology on dreaming, he was sort of a post-Jungian, you might call him, he always, you know, said that to understand dreams and to live sort of soulfully and mythically, you had to have a poetic basis of mind. So being in nature and holding your own dreams requires this poetic basis of mind, not this linear grid-like thinking, but this more rhizome, echoing, patterned, curving sort of way of being in the world. As a mapper and a surveyor, literally, you know, I've seen how most Western towns were laid out on a grid back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And you see physically how that was the precursor to breaking, in some ways, our relationship to nature. Because it didn't follow the geography. And so all this stuff somehow interweaves for me. And it's funny, you know, you could say, why I call what I do dream tracking is inherently related to the mapping work I was doing in what I jokingly call the default world back in the day when I wasn't as close to nature. So
aren't maps like the Forest Service maps, you know, they have that grid, and if you want to buy parcels of land, you do it in these 90-degree angles.
Right.
And there's, I think, Ron the Ranch is trying to buy this piece, but he's trying to make diagonals, which sometimes the
literature. Oh, really? Yeah.
Because right now it's like steps, it looks like, you know.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So there's like the corner of a building, like just the corner is technically on Forest Service land.
Okay.
It's a problem.
Yeah. Right.
Because of legal stuff.
Right. Because of
someone
legal
hurts
stuff.
Themselves on that corner.
You know, right.
Forest Service, hey, man, we don't want to deal with this.
Well, you know, the original 13 colonies were mapped by geography. You followed the curving of the waterways, the ridge tops, the valleys.
Well, it's and, simpler in a sense.
Right, and so you notice on the East Coast, many towns are quaint and the streets are curved and so on because they originally designed according to the land. Once they did all the great surveys to the west, and this western town was on a grid system, because they didn't know what to expect. And so everything's laid out. Baseline Street, Boulder, Colorado. A baseline is the starting line of any survey that happens. It was named that because that's
what wasn't this the last place to be geologically surveyed?
Yeah, it's mapped in the post office and eroded. Yeah, no, totally.
To me, it's sort of it's there's an echo of that today of like how it speaks to its inconvenience.
Yes,
and that's sort of why it's also still so beautiful because we never, no one ever made a big city right here. If they did, it'd be.
Exactly.
Ruined.
Yeah. And we should appreciate inconvenience because it has great curves.
It's the greatest it's the greatest asset.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you don't mind, I am a little curious just how you got to this place and time, not just here physically, but to the state of mind. I mean, you where did you grow up?
I was born in San Francisco and grew up in the Bay Area on actually Stanford University. My stepfather, who raised me with my mother and his father, so my step-grandfather, was a medieval history professor at Stanford University.
Medieval history?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was a fascinating man.
What was his name?
He was William Bark, B-A-R-K, yeah. And so, and he... you know, he had little like statues of satyrs in his house and, you know, very steeped in even the Greek mythology and sort of the old Western world, I guess, ways. And so that captured my fascination. And he was a very sort of play acting, loved reading poetry out loud. So I grew up, you know, and, you know, even though I had to dress up for holidays, there was always sort of poetry and literary imagination going on and stuff like that.
With your father, too, and your parents? Or is it most coming
back down? Then, but then it sort of changed. Yeah. because my stepfather actually worked for the Hoover Institution, which is a conservative Republican think tank. Mm-hmm. And so it was this contrast of the grandfather who is still sort of somewhat wild and imaginative, and the stepfather who is a little bit more...
it's like a Nixon Republican or before that?
A Reagan Republican.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, and so those contrasts were interesting because I grew up with both sort of a hard-edged discipline, and this is how you succeed in life. This is, you're supposed to, you know, this is basically, you know, you go to college, you get your degree, you enter a firm, you know, this is how you do it. You invest your money. That's how it all goes.
Yeah, I had the same thing.
Yeah.
More sort of.
And so I never just, none of that ever, without being able to put a word on it, none of it ever made sense. And there was a part of me as a kid that already seemed to be, I could say now, maybe born with this poetic sort of sensibility. And it seemed weak as a kid. It was something I hid. But I had dreams as a kid where I'd go out onto the lawn. I had a hard time sleeping inside even as a kid, and I still sleep in a tent at age 49 now. And but we had redwoods on the property and old fairy rings actually on the grass. One night I was sleeping out there, and I dreamed I saw myself sleeping, and all these little figures came out of the bushes and were dancing around me, and I woke up scared shitless, and I swear that they had all just disappeared back into the bushes.
Maybe
and
they
I know I didn't know if it was reality or not, but I went back into the house and slept that night. I woke up my twin brother, and I was probably 10 at that point. He's like, "What are you doing in my bed?" And I was like, I told him the dream. He's like, "You're crazy." And but you know, so my childhood was again this contradictory thing of here's reality, the sort of straight line reality. Here's what you're supposed to do. And then these inferences of maybe a truer reality for me.
What about your mother? What was her influence?
She's French. She was born in France. And she was a traditional sort of housewife and you know, very caring, very nurturing, you know, but not a lot of influence on who I was, the direction I was going. She was sort of the grounding aspect, but she never, you know, she just accepted who we were.
So So this male lineage is a bit more formative for you.
It was definitely more, exactly.
What it means to walk the world.
Right.
And how to do it.
Yeah, this is how you, this is a measure of success. This is how you follow it. And that never worked for me. You know, when I got to college, I ended up going into geology because field work, we always got to travel and camp. And yeah, and I just had a nap. I you know, all through my 20s, I couldn't sleep inside. So whenever we went anywhere, you know, I was always setting
literally
up camping.
Literally couldn't sleep?
Literally
couldn't
sleep.
Or you just didn't like it?
I didn't like it, but I had a hard time sleeping inside. And so I spent, you know, I've spent more nights outside than I have inside in my lifetime.
The winter too?
In the, well, in California, it's not much of a winter. But in the winter too, even here, I mean, a wall tent, you know, I don't consider inside because you can hear the owls and the coyotes at night, right?
Yeah.
And the wind and the
Do you have a
rain.
Wood stove in there?
Do have a wood stove, of course. Yeah, of course. Comfort's important.
Do you have any bales or anything? Or
you know, we do. We hang wool blankets and insulate in between. In
Basically,
the
you got to keep that fire on.
Yeah, you got to cut more wood than you need. Yeah. So, but so also, you know, geology led to mapping, and so most of my life I was wandering upon landscapes, taking it in. What are these places? I lived in Montana for 14 years. Rivers, mountains. And slowly I felt like that stuff seeped into me, and that's what makes me who I am. And so this idea of places, dreamscapes, landscapes, they've shaped what I am, and I feel like I'm in a symbiotic relationship. My life is sort of co-evolving with the places I've been in, if that makes sense.
Yeah, do you feel this is something anyone can do, or is this something you have a particular predilection for because of your upbringing and your mind and the ability that you've been outside so much most of your life?
I don't know. The modern world is the modern world, but to me it seems like a very natural way of living, or as water flows, the path of least resistance for me. And it's given me an immensely rich life. I can say I've had teachers in life, but I know the best teachers I've had are dreams and wild nature. You know, not if
yeah.
That, yeah.
So if you say it's difficult to do on your own, kind of like re-enter a dream and work with them, what have you been doing? Have you had teachers or what? I mean, you obviously have a very intimate relationship with your dreams. So aside from writing them down or recording them.
Right. So
what do you do?
In Missoula, I was at the crux in my mapping and surveying career of here I am mapping a landscape. I'm setting linear lines on it, cutting it up. You know, doing everything we've been talking against, interpreting it, sort of objectifying
it, in a sense,
but sort of unconscious of it for a long time. Because basically I was falling out an explorer's myth. I want to walk the land and wander it and discover and be in nature. But at the same time, this mapping is contradictory to it, right?
You've heard the phrase, when the map becomes the territory.
Exactly, yeah. The map is not the territory.
That was a slow process where maybe you started to wake up, or like, wait a minute, is this map becoming the territory?
It actually ruined me in a way that I couldn't define to my friends. It sort of started breaking me open and causing, in some ways, an illness and certainly a disturbance in me. And along that time, as I was... very much against what I was doing, even though I was doing it, I started having some dreams that started knocking me flat. And one dream in particular was this dream where I'm looking down at a boat that's gotten stuck on a sandbar, and it's been trying to, and there's an island just ahead of it. It's been trying to get to this island, and it got stuck. It's like so close to reaching this place it's been trying to reach. And I'm witnessing this in the dream. All of a sudden, a wave pulses off this island, which is sort of counterintuitive. Usually the waves come
backwards
from the other direction.
Yeah.
And it comes out and it lifts the boat off the sandbar. It turns it 180 degrees away from the island and sends it back out to sea. Mm-hmm. At that moment, this huge grief within the dream erupts in me. And I realize that I'm the pilot of that ship and I'm asleep under the decks. And I wake up weeping. And, you know, all through my life there, I you know, weeping wasn't something I did or was allowed or being a man, you know, and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I was going crazy when I woke up, and I was scared, and I was full of grief, and I didn't understand what was going on.
Just because of the intensity of that grief, that feeling.
And that dream, yeah.
That's what scared you.
Yeah, it did.
Like,
and
a
so
premonition, in a sense, or like,
yeah, I didn't.
So strong that you're not quite sure.
I didn't
it is.
Know. The dream just left me with this feeling that I'd never experienced in life. And I felt like I was breaking apart. Yeah. Well, so that's what I did. It moved me through my utter skepticism of astrologists, dream workers. I mean, there's a lot of quote woo woo new age stuff going on in Missoula, and that's how I considered those people. And I'd heard of this woman, Anita Doyle, from many friends, and I'd always been like, whatever, you know, that's not my path. And Tim, my buddy, sure, she's great for you, but, you know, whatever. And so I woke up, and I'd called her within 15 minutes.
What does she do?
She works with dreams. She works with the I Ching as a oracle, and she's also an astrologist, an evolutionary astrologist after Stephen Forster. And, so, you know, a mixed bag of things. And I called her up, and I was in her office within about an hour, and she worked with me in this dream. And I was completely... She basically took me in under a wing, and she was my lifeline, and I completely depended on her. And then she taught me a lot of the basics of dreams over the next year. And I worked with her, and I found out, you know, all my skepticism and sort of brought up judgment and so on was simply a defense against something.
But where did that dream go? The one with the boat?
Well, I basically ended... The next 3 or 4 years was like a whole new journey out on some trackless ocean that I'd never been on. The place I'd been trying to get to, this level of success, that island, right? It wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. And the water, or sort of the deep unknown, mm-hmm. picked me up, turned me around, and to my great terror and grief, threw me back out in the trackless ocean. And that was the next 3 or 4 years of my life, was finding my way in this strange new territory that didn't have rules I understood, that was full of emotion and deep feeling, and was a language I had no idea. And you could say it was an initiation of sorts that I didn't choose.
Mm. Wow. So when you continued on with your life, and when you've been living even further away from those grids and maps, out here, and I know you were telling me that you haven't even traveled a lot, like on airplanes and stuff, for the past few years. You kind of realized that.
Yeah.
And so there's been a certain groundedness to your last few years. You know, this whole podcast series is riffing off my song, 10 Laws, and it's the idea of, you know, the 10 Laws are a list that a certain friend of mine made, riffing off the Hunter-Gatherer's Code of 10. It's sort of like the stars that keep his life straight. Like, if he knows those 10 laws, then he's like, well, I got the basics covered.
Right.
And it also has a bit about right livelihood in there. And so, and the rest is icing on the cake. And that's something he works with. And he's like, I'll change it at any time. But there you go. Those are my 10 laws. I'm not asking you to give me 10, but what are some things that have come up for you by living this way, by working with your dreams, that kind of work? What works for you? And that could be something very simple practice you like to do every morning. It could also just be like a state of mind of knowing, like, I know less, and that's the beauty, in a sense. You know, I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I could name a few things that it's just things that, I guess, as you get older, but you have a unique situation of how you've been living.
Right.
And I think that living and that work you've been doing has been giving you some gifts, and maybe they're like asking fish what water is, but if there's anything you could put your finger on, that would be helpful.
Yeah, well, let me, I'm just going to go with it here, but...
You can riff, you can retract. Yeah.
But sort of, well, I mean, on a real literal basis...
Totally.
My discipline is I wake up every morning and I'm half in the dream realm and I'm thinking and writing down or voice recording dreams.
So you take some time to kind of, with that buffer zone.
You know, a big, I guess, you know, being the fish now looking outside of the fishbowl that I'm in, if you can call it that, is that imagination is my greatest friend and teacher. that imaginative realm, that dream realm, that other realm. Mm-hmm. And I give it a lot of attention naturally during the day.
Mm-hmm.
I drop out of a linear, fear-driven sort of worrying. You know, we all go there. We have our hydraulic cycles where we bounce back in there. But I don't know, there's something about nature that gives me this open awareness. When I find myself stuck in my head, I go outside and I look around, I listen to the ravens that are flying over there. I look at the pattern on the rock. If I feel really stuck, I go and I hang out by the creek until something starts flowing back through me. Does that, you know? So mm-hmm. those sorts of real simple actions. But again, I look, it's like I'm looking to the presence of the place I'm in to show me what to do.
You're tapping in through your senses, like listening.
Yeah.
Observing.
So as a hunter-gatherer way, it's, you know, awareness is, you know, we, I think a lot of times when we talk about awareness, we're thinking mental awareness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about visceral body, embodied awareness.
Yeah, which is similar to how you're saying to approach dreams.
Exactly.
Through feeling, through metaphor.
Yeah.
Through connections and patterns.
Yeah. There, again, you know, it's like when we're, dreams are, I call it dream tracking, because I feel like we're following the presence of an animal. And as every good hunter knows, when you're stalking something, when you're hunting something, it's also hunting you. As you move towards something, it's moving towards you. And so this idea that, are we predator or prey to the dream? I don't know. Does it matter? But, you know, in all good mythology, you know, all the old stories have a danger in them. And it's about sort of actually walking that thread of danger. If there's no challenge, then you're in a, and this is something that I, you know, speaking of your 10 rules, if I'm bored or if I'm too comfortable, which I like being comfortable,
yeah,
right?
It doesn't.
I realize that I need to challenge myself. And then, you know, I go through this pattern. Okay, what's my new challenge? And I get angry because I've, then once I challenge myself, then I have to follow it through. And part of me is upset for upsetting my own balance. But it's this tricky thing where you have to nudge and poke yourself too to keep that spark and that spirit and that fire alive. And so,
yeah, like if you're not challenging yourself, or I guess we all go through challenges, but it's difficult to walk through life crisis to crisis.
Right.
So you know, there's those middle grounds and you're just like, oh, when's the next thing coming?
Right.
And then it's this weird like wave thing versus like, then you just feel like a buoy in an ocean being bounced around.
Right.
You
know, Jung always said, I think he had it carved, Carl Jung, you know, he was, you know, regardless of Jungian psychology, Jung himself is a historical character. Character was a fascinating man. And carved over his door, yeah, he said, you know, whether you know it or not, the gods are here. In other words, or, you know, or something to the extent that what you don't face on the inside then comes to you from the outside. And so this idea of fate and sort of open awareness. And so dreams constantly are giving you those premonitions of maybe where your life wants to take you, maybe where you're stuck. It's giving you this internal awareness that comes, I think, from nature itself and the greater collective and the slipstream of consciousness that's underneath the you know, that's in the depths of everything, that sort of inherent language we all speak, and gives us a path, our path. And you never see it clearly, but you hear it, you get allured, you follow one thing to the next, and it keeps leading you on. Talk about, we're getting back to our allurement and dreams, right? It's the beckoning finger, right? Come this way.
Through the fog.
Yeah, it's, come hither. Nature does
this. There seems to be some kind of rules of the game to life, too, and synchronicity plays in this way, where there always is that finger, that hand beckoning you just enough through the fog, just enough to see every now and then.
Right.
But it's never clear, and that seems to be part of the purpose of life. And it's frustrating.
Yeah.
But otherwise, there would be no point of being here. And I say that to mean, like, if the yellow brick road was always in front of you, all you had to do is just follow it.
Right.
what would you be doing here? There's no choices to make.
Right.
If there's no choices to make, there's no karma. You know, if there's no karma, then I don't know. It's like,
right. Well, you'd sort of be walking dead.
Yeah. You'd be zombies. Yeah. In a weird way. It's sort of like, if anything, it's a recognition that the suffering that we feel and like the desire and all this stuff, it obviously serves a purpose. And if anything, it's evidenced by things like dreams, these things that's the beckoning hand. That's just not, it's just the minimum enough.
Right. You know? It is. And that's what's, you know, some people in old stories will call longing and mystery. And a life without longing is not a life, right? The longing is actually, if it gets fulfilled, then what, right? No, it's this constant fire, tiny light you're following, right? Mm-hmm. And so longing, that yearning and that sort of, what, you know, you also said frustration, but that feeling that makes your heart ache, that's actually what keeps us alive and going.
Yeah, it's been described by, and I've heard it described by spiritual teachers as, you know, the yearning to be reunited with God, like that which you are.
Right.
And if you like the fingertips, it's like, it's just, there's this deep longing to just like, you know, in your heart, what it means to be, it's just pure existence, loving awareness. And that's a part of you too.
Right.
And there's all these layers in front of us that we're like working through, and they kind of come and go, and we have these ecstatic moments and we have these dreams that maybe like really shake us, but then we have all the mundane stuff too.
Right.
And
after the ecstasy, the laundry, right?
Yeah, exactly. You chop the wood, right?
Yeah.
And carry the water.
That's Jack Kornfield who wrote that book.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I think it's a great reminder what you're talking about. And I would think that the more you do things like work with your dreams, track with your dreams, it seems to set your mind and your body, it tunes the antenna to notice the larger patterns in your life and the larger myth that you are living. Because this stuff is going on all the time. It really is just a matter of how much we're paying attention and how much choice we're putting into working with it.
Right.
And that's a much more active way to be living your life. When the average person feels like a victim.
Right.
Things are just happening to them.
Right.
And what that gets sort of diluted into is sort of these cliche spiritual teachings like, you know, you choose what you want, sort of the secret type stuff.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, but it's more of a dance, you know?
Right.
And there's like the way sound hits a wall and bounces back to you. There, yes, something's coming to you, but what did you first put out that made that sound, you know?
Right.
Maybe that's choice. Maybe that's every little step we take in our life. And so maybe the dream is a form of ricochet. It's a form of, you know, the way ripples in a lake go like this and they cross and now they're interacting, creating these new patterns. And
right. And know, dreams actually talk to each other.
Right. And we move throughout the universe, and so we're making ripples.
Right.
And so sort of like listening for the echoes back.
Yeah, I guess our own form in some ways of echolocation, right?
Yeah.
You could even say dreams. I mean, it's the way they move us. They do move us forward. And, you know, you were saying challenges, frustrating without challenges. But usually spirit or soul never gives us anything beyond our capacity, even though we think it's beyond our capacity.
Yeah, it was Charles Eisenstein, when he would see someone who's super, super depressed or going through something really hard, he'd say to them, congratulations, like you're a really brave soul. Like I can sense that, like,
nice, yeah.
You know, wow, you're really strong.
Right.
You know, like, wow, look what you got yourself into.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Now imagine depression with a full set of dreaming where you find yourselves dreaming that you're in swamps, you're in bogs, you're at the nadir of something, and you get all this rich imagery and sense of feeling, and that really drives it home. Because depression, I know in our modern world, is considered a bad place, but it's actually a place that we need to ground into, and so we can also keep going. They're just cycles in life. And so dreams are really fascinating in showing us our own inner geography that way, too.
Depression can be very insidious, though. I mean, it's something that's sort of like a snowball. it's sort of depressing your spirit in a sense. So I've always looked at it. It doesn't feel good because there's something, there's some sort of like imbalance or disharmony or whatever it is that is not allowing you to live as you are, in a sense. Or maybe there's some, I do agree that there's a natural cycle in a sense to it, and it's not so good just to push it away with drugs or.
Well, I think, yeah. And like, I think
which a lot of people do, I mean,
right. But drugs without the imagination and the talk therapy and so on is a way of not actually addressing what's going on. And
yeah,
some, you know, there's some belief, and Hillman would talk about this too, that soul is the veil, the valley, and spirit is the peak. And we're in a modern culture that so denies the deep, the valley, the hell, the lower, the other, the underworlds,
right,
that now we don't know how to survive in them, and we become victims in them rather than seeing them as something equally important as a heaven or a high place.
Oh, for sure. It's written into our constitution,
right?
The pursuit of happiness.
And so, you know, and that's just one way of looking at it. But again, dreams literally give us, you know, the geography and places, and dreams are really interesting because where they place us is big indication of things.
Wow, man. Well, we can probably wrap it up, but you work with people, right? I'm pretty sure you have a website.
So, yeah.
Because I've seen it.
I do. It's called ravendreamtracking.com.
And how do you work with folks that aren't with you in person?
I phone, I Skype, I travel and do workshops, all that. Constance and I will even take apprentices here for more than just dreaming, but dreaming is one aspect of that. Wow. If you want to be close to the land and work, we'll customize things to work things out that way. So, because, you know, dreaming and being in a wild place are the things I like sharing together. So,
well, those are two good things.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you for doing this. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much, Trevor. I really appreciate it too. And, yep. Keep awesome. Dreaming.
Thanks, buddy. Well, there it is. Another episode of 10 Laws with East Forest Podcast. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to Matt for giving us his time and his ideas and his wisdom. And thank you to you for listening. The music you're hearing in the background is called Second Attention, and that is from the album The Education of the Individual Soul, the first debut East Forest record. It's got a lot of field recordings in there, including things from Culebra, Puerto Rico, some geese from Oregon, and I just really like the vibe of it. The bass guitar is played by Amit Stryker. I always had trouble pronouncing that. He's Israeli. He's a badass player. Please do say hi. Send in any questions or comments at info@eastforest.org. And we'll catch you next time. Keep walking your walk. Don't take any shit. But if you do, do it with grace.